All right, thanks. I first got in touch with Dan after I was browsing through, the atheist books at, I don't know, Barnes & Noble or something, and I saw this book, Godless, which is, you know, quite a provocative title. I picked it up and just started reading it there in the aisle, and saw his involvement in Christian music, and I thought, and even mentioned Southern California, I said, I got to get in touch with this guy. So I dashed him off an email, and he was kind enough to respond to it. Let me just start by asking you, how many here are, would you qualify yourselves as lifelong or very long-time unbelievers? All right. How many more recent converts? Or deconverts, as it were. Yeah, give them. And how many here, we're going to have an altar call for deconversion at the end, so how many here are still religious? All right, just checking. Usually, you know, I teach history of rock at James Madison. We have 306 students every semester, and it's quite a large class. And of course, in the group that I was in, we played for large audiences all the time, but this is the first time I've addressed a group that's made up almost completely of unbelievers, and I'm tempted to say, you're all going to hell. On the other hand, it makes me think of that bumper sticker, you know, where are we going and why are we in this handbasket? All right, well, let's detail my own trip to hell. And I'm an artist. I'm not a scientist, and I'm not a philosopher. And this is, I think, an important distinction to make, an obvious one, but, you know, I was listening to the speakers last night, and many of the books that we all read, we depend on science and philosophy. We even, to some degree, depend on theologians to find out what the other side, if you want to call it that, is thinking. Art, on the other hand, is a little bit different. We depend on the raw material from science and philosophy and hopefully bring some interpretive meaning to it. How does this impact my world? How am I to think about this? How can I put this into some kind of meaningful context? So the arts bring meaning to that. I think it's also meaningful to point out that laws, but also facts, as critically important as both are often not enough to change our hearts. Absolutely essential. But can they change our hearts? I mean, if you look at the history of the civil rights movement, yes, we had the desegregation laws, but it was when at concerts where black artists were playing and they had a rope down the middle of the audience, one side for the blacks, one side for the whites, and they started dancing and the rope came down. They started dancing with each other, which was absolutely scandalous. But that's what it takes to change people's hearts. Laws and facts are essential, but it's the arts that really appeal to people's hearts. Well, let me start at the beginning by referencing Dr. Shermer's book here, The Believing Brain. I always had a sense of God in my life from my earliest memories. And it might have had something to do with the fact that my mother was an Italian Catholic whose mother was one of 19 children. Well, between 16 and 19, they're not sure, because they lost some in childbirth. But I know that the youngest of those had 9 children himself. And his name was Fred. We called him Uncle Fred. And he was devoutly Catholic, Italian guy in Philadelphia. And he made his family of 11, him plus his wife and the 9 kids, sit through one decade of the rosary every night before dinner. And we were threatened, if you don't behave, you're going to go to Uncle Fred's for the weekend. Holy shit, anything but that, please. Well, I did. I always had a sense of God because it was a big piece of my childhood. I remember a dream that I had where I couldn't have been older than 5 years old. I actually wrote a song on this, put it on a record, where I was in the Vatican, and I was dead. And I was in a line of dead souls waiting to ascend a staircase to heaven. And so the dream interpreted to me that went through the Vatican. And now the Pope was walking around, and he could see us, but nobody else could see us. So the Pope knew that we were there, but nobody else did. So this vivid imagery, first grade, a year later, the nun told us a story of the statue of the baby Jesus in the church animating, coming to life and playing with these two lonely children. Well, I was lonely too. I went to and this is the honest truth, I went to the church after school that day and knelt down in front of the altar because we had a statue of the baby Jesus in our church, and I prayed that the statue of the baby Jesus would come to life and play with me. I was 6 years old. Of course, we know the ending of that story. Well, anyway, so I had a sense of God, always. I wanted God to be real. I used to watch Bernadette of Lourdes, Ben-Hur, Greatest Story Ever Told, all these religious movies, and the music was so moving. You know, they know how to do this, to appeal to our deepest, you know, most powerful places, and I wanted God to be real very, very much, and yet I couldn't find a way. I wished so bad I could have lived back then. I could have walked with Jesus. I could have seen him rise from the dead. I could have seen him walk on the water or not, and but there's that. So from my oldest memories, I had a believing brain. And at some point, of course, we have to adjust, we have to get over it, because it just doesn't happen. So I grew up in high school, I left the church altogether, stopped going. God was not present in my world, that's just the way it was. I got on with my life. I was invited, left religion altogether. I was invited to be in a band in high school, and just to show you that I'm a good sport, I think I'm going to show you some pictures of what that looked like. Enough of that one. Sometime later, very shortly later, actually, I had an uncle who told me that there was this church in Costa Mesa, Calvary Chapel, that had Christian rock bands, and maybe I'd like to go down and check them out. And so I said, sure, and I went with him. And this is a very large church, spearheaded much of the Jesus movement in the early, very early 70s, maybe even late 60s. And he was right, and in the church, it's held about 3,000 people, mostly young people. They were wearing, you know, they were coming in barefoot or with sandals and jeans and shorts, and they sang songs, and they were very much animated and energized by their faith. So this idea of religion and culture, I responded to that as a young man, and this was my answer to that need that I had for God to be real in my life. I really wanted God to be real in my life, and boy, God sure seemed real to these people and their lives, so, you know, there it was, and I went forward in an altar call, and immediately launched my mission from God. The band that I was in started playing Christian music. We started writing our own songs, and you see, I didn't grow up in the Protestant sociology that Dan came from. I was Catholic, so we didn't have a lot of the same restraints, but he's absolutely right. The church, Christian rock, was an oxymoron in some of those Protestant evangelical circles. No sooner had they started getting used to someone coming in with long hair and an acoustic guitar rather than playing piano or an organ than here we came with kind of, you know, tattoos and mohawks and ripped jeans and boots and spikes and leathers and all this kind of stuff and earrings and whatnot. And, you know, I personally didn't care what they thought. We were on a mission from God. We were playing nightclubs and college campuses and high schools, and we wanted to communicate through the music we knew what we thought we had found. We were approached... Oh, wait, no, that's what, I'm sorry, that's not my band. How'd that get in there? I don't... There's actually another one that I had debated putting in, four gentlemen, older gentlemen in a suit, and the title of the record was He Touched Me, and I just couldn't do... Well, we were approached by a company by the name of Maranatha Music because we had developed a little bit of a following, and they asked us to do our first record, and so we did. Here's a picture a friend sent me of some of our early album covers up on the left, upper left, and on the right, some of the merchandise from those concerts. And some of you might have seen the God Rules sticker. It made its rounds, and was actually ripped off by a number of Christian merchandising companies who I actually called up and said, "Hey, that's mine." They said, "Huh, you can't copyright a slogan, schmuck. God bless you, schmuck." Well, Maranatha Music was a parachurch organization. They were the record company that was owned by Calvary Chapel, the church that started a lot of the Jesus Movement stuff. And as such, they were famous for their praise albums. And does anyone have those early praise albums? So you know what I'm talking about. It's very mild. It's stuff to be played in church. You know, it's praise albums. And then, well, how does that kind of record company deal with this? They started a label called A&S for edgier music, and now A&S's claim to fame was Sam Phillips. Any Sam Phillips fans in here? Okay, you know her. She's a great artist, and she writes for television shows. She was married to T-Bone Burnett, who's produced all kinds of movie music and records and so on. But again, then here we come. We had quite a following. There were a lot of bands that were spin-offs of what we were doing. We're talking about rather extreme music, loud, alternative music, punk rock, heavy metal, and the churches are going, well, what are we going to do with this? So Maranatha Music started yet another label called Broken Records and hired me to be a staff producer there, brought me in as a mentor for new groups. This is a postcard that they produced back. I guess we're talking about the early 80s here, and you can see this is taking a candid shot at a concert where I'm just surrounded by kids who want to know about the band, want to know about Jesus, and these are some of the groups I produced on the outer edges there. But the postcard says, "Greetings from Broken Records." Well, it's the back of this postcard that's really interesting. If you want to get an idea for what kind of organization this was. I don't know if you can see this or not. Can you read it? Let me just try to pick out some of the highlights. Broken Records is an unprovoked attack on complacency. Broken Records is a clear, uncompromised call to the unsaved, unchurched, and culturally disenfranchised within the body of Christ. Broken Records is radical restructuring of relationships between music and the church, between artists and audience, between business and labor. Broken Records is people over product, vision over vinyl. Broken Records is surrendered independent. Ooh, love that one. Broken Records is armed and dangerous. Broken Records is a militant response to the trickle-down theory of evangelism, meaning we're in your face. Broken Records is a foolish thing to confound the wise. This was my record label. Well, we released three records on that label, and our group's logo was designed by a gentleman whose name is Rick Griffin. Now, does anyone know that name? He's one of the quintessential San Francisco artists, did Grateful Dead record covers, concerts for the Fillmore, Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix. He also did our logo, and I have a book that he graciously autographed for me. But this highlights the militant approach that we had to what we were doing, Onward Christian Soldier. That's very much what it was like. So we did this, 250 dates a year. This one in Canada. Yes, that's me, somewhere. All over North America and Europe we did this. Giving altar calls. The lights come down, the music comes up, you know the scriptures to say. There's powerful stuff that you can use to bring people forward. More on that shortly. Well, reality often interferes with the best laid plans. Now, I guess lots of us go through divorce, 52% of us by statistical means. Of course, According to the Barna Group, atheists do better than the religious, so we're probably less than 52%. So congratulations. But nonetheless, a good number of us have had the misfortune of having to endure this. So it's not an uncommon thing, but it was sure as hell uncommon for me, because here I am, a mentor surrounded by little kids, and by the way, I'm going through a divorce right now, and how do you deal with this? Not just how do you deal with the divorce and the scandalous aspect of it, but the bigger question to me is, why was my faith so powerless to do anything about teaching me what it was like to be married, to do anything about building the kind of character I needed to be a successful human being in a functioning world? I had four beautiful kids. So that was my question, and as a result, I wrote this album, Branded. I'm going to play you a song off of this, but I just want to comment on the imagery here. Yes, that's a tattoo. It's on this arm right here. So the idea of branded had multiple meanings for me. Number one, I was branded in the sense that you know, once you go through a scandal like divorce in the Christian church, you're kind of branded, not a heretic necessarily, but you know, your star's dimmed a little bit. You've been kicked down a number or two. But for me, and the imagery of the tattoo is more important, that yes, I wanted to keep my faith. I was branding myself a Christian. And so we released this record, and this is where I documented the process, not only of my divorce, but what it was like to deal with the failure of my faith. And I don't mean to blame my faith. I assume full responsibility for myself. But really, the faith I was practicing, the things that I believed in, were completely powerless in any meaningful way in my life at all. So we released this record, and it was powerful. It's 25 years ago this year. In fact, the record label did a re-release, and it's regularly shown up in right now there's a list coming out where it's in the top 50 Christian music records of all time. Okay, so let me play you a song that kind of is the for those that have sensitive ears, this is a good time to get the cotton out. I'm going to put the lyrics up for you so that you can see that even then, as a Christian, I was dealing with the idea of doubt and the failure of this faith.
Yeah.
Well, so 1986, you know, I'm coming unraveled. I wonder why I tried so hard, and now I wonder why I have no power. In my darkest hour, I need to see you there. I really need to see you there. No, I wrote the song, and people have been based on it. You know, this idea that God will never leave you or forsake you, I don't know what that means in my world. You must have alternate meanings for those words, because I don't know what that means. If I'm at a point, the lowest point of my life, when, and many of us get there, and I cannot find any meaningful manifestation of God at all, all right, well, there's other issues too, but this was real for me, that God was absent. More than that, I look back at those lyrics and I refer and I lay claim to the imagery of Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, crying out, sweating tears that turn to blood, God, deliver me from this cup, not my will, but thine be done. Oh, the mythology is strong with this one. And we do. We appeal to these very strong stories that are compelling, because we want to believe that we're loved. We want to believe that we're special. We want to believe that there's an answer out there. We want to believe that in our darkest hours, there's somewhere to turn, that some magic bullet, some pill, something. And there's just not. 1987, a year after this record was released, I bought Broken Records, that record label, and I changed the name to Brainstorm Artists. We were distributed by Warden Sony, as Dan said. We produced well over 100 records, won all those awards. We shifted the focus because it was obvious to me that evangelicalism didn't work. But I was still holding on to my faith. Nonetheless, we shifted from a less militant view to a more art-based form of Christian music. So I held that label for a number of years and sold it eventually. I was tired of the hypocrisy that I saw. I saw other artists whose lives were ruined, alcoholism, drug addiction, all kinds of messes. And I don't mean to say that this is caused by religion, but I'll tell you what, I do believe that it's perpetuated because they stay in religion and there is no power there. There just is nothing. Of course, you know this. I'm preaching to the choir if there ever was such a concept, you know. Forgive me for that. We played scattered concerts, Chicago in 2000 and various other concerts with my band and various, and by and large, I'm becoming unraveled. I stayed in a period of, all right, well, I believe in the fundamentals of Christianity, but I don't have any... you know, we were doing Christian music, playing the same songs. I could deliver a sermon. And it's not that I don't feel like I was hypocritical, because I did believe the things that I was saying. But, you know, the rain falls on the just and the unjust alike. And I can't promise anybody anything. There's no there, so I can't promise you anything. All I can say is you need to believe in Jesus. Now here's this song, you know, and that's pretty much the way it was. Well, I was coming unraveled. 2007, I took my job at James Madison University, and in 2008, I knew not a soul there. And so I'm going to have confession here, excuse me. I signed up for a dating website, and I just to meet people. I didn't know anybody, and I came into contact with a scientist, and she was an atheist. First atheist I actually knew, met, and... we only talked two or three times, but she said, you know, the first time we did talk, she said, if you're going to, she Googled me, of course, and then, boy, the whole thing comes showing up. And she says, I want you to know that if you're going to try to convert me or if you think I'm going to hell, I'm not going to go out with you. Of course, all the Christians, I've told this story in print, and they say, see, it's always a woman that's behind this. Well, it got me to thinking, you know, it got me to thinking, what do I believe in hell? Because I could tell you, you know, there's this book by Rob Bell now. Is anyone familiar with that book? And he's trying to work his way through the idea that hell is still a possible, coherent idea, and it's simply not, especially if you want to postulate the existence of an all-loving God. It's ridiculous. And I knew that. You know, the Dante thing just is, you know, just doesn't work. So I had constructed my own idea of what hell must be like. Of course, I couldn't abandon the idea. There it is in Scripture. And here's this woman saying, if you're going to tell me that I'm going to hell, I don't want to be your friend. And so it really caused me to think, well, what do I believe? And you know, I woke up one day and said, God, I don't believe any of it. I just don't believe any of it. It's all bullshit. I've been making shit up my whole life. Well, you know, Keith Parsons, a wonderful philosopher, had this to say. To refute, and he's talking about two scholars who are arguing for the existence of hell. He says this, to refuse to believe in hell is to measure God's thoughts by ours. You know, that you've all heard this argument. God's ways are higher than our ways, and we don't know the mind of God. Well, Parsons has this to say. Allow me at once to plead guilty to measuring God's thoughts by my own. As I see it, I have no other choice. If my intellect and my deepest moral convictions tell me that hell is a monstrous dogma, unworthy of belief by decent human beings, then I can think of no greater sin I could commit than to accept such a doctrine. It is a sad but edifying spectacle to see how intelligent defenders of the indefensible tie themselves in ethical and conceptual knots. And that's exactly what I had done. I had to wake up and say, you know what? That's exactly what I've done. I've tied myself in knots trying to rationalize and justify things that cannot be rationalized or justified. So I said, yeah, we can go out. That was easy. Well, we didn't. You know, we had a couple of nice chats, and it was. But it was an instrumental time for me. During those couple of chats that we did have, she told me that she thought I had a responsibility to come out and to announce this to my Christian audience. And I disagreed with her. I said, you know, I couldn't really possibly care less. It's been a number of years since I've been out of Christian music anyway, and, you know, my phone's not exactly ringing off the hook with people that are overly concerned with the well-being of my eternal soul. So I'm just inclined to say, you know, screw the whole thing and let the world get on with itself. You know, I had a great job at JMU. I had actually done interviews in Christian magazines a few over the years, but I kind of avoided the topic of whether I actually believed anything. And I wasn't, again, being hypocritical. I just didn't say anything that I didn't believe in. Everything I said, I believed, and just didn't go there on the doctrine stuff. Well, once I acknowledged to myself that I'm an unbeliever, I of course began reading everything I could get my hands on. Of course, read all the Dawkins and Hitchens and all that stuff. Dennett and Sam Harris is wonderful. And of course, this is where I picked up Dan's book, Godless, in the bookstore. I just soaked it all in. I think I read the whole book standing in the aisle. So I'm very, very grateful. It's a very thorough book. But the problem was this, and I would submit to you that this is a fundamental problem, that I had no context for a life away from the idea of God. Many of you have. So many hands went up when I asked how many of you are lifelong atheists. You get it. I sat at breakfast with someone this morning, where are you, that said you're a second-generation atheist. We're very lucky, you know, but I had no idea, an Italian Catholic, I had two first Holy Communions for crying out loud. How do you do this? What worldview, how do you think about reality? So it wasn't enough just to offer me facts. It's like, all right, well, how do I construct a worldview out of this? Very shortly after, this book came out, God's Not Dead and Neither Are We. I have a chapter in this book. It was an interview done before I acknowledged to myself that I don't believe any of it. And And this guy contacted me, said, I would appreciate if you would form a Facebook page and help me promote the book. I had not done Facebook. So I said, okay, sure, I'm glad to do that. I had no idea what I was getting into. Next thing I know, I've got hundreds of people coming on board. And now I'm forced with the crisis. I've got to be honest with these people or not. And of course, that was an easy choice to make. I was not willing to be untruthful about where I was, what I believed in. My fear was that I wouldn't have all the right answers. If someone asked me a question about the beginning of the universe and the Big Bang Theory, remember, I'm not a scientist, I'm not a philosopher, I'm an artist. I don't know. And so that was my fear. What I didn't know is that I don't need the right answers. All I need is the right questions. And I would submit that to you that's one way to approach this. It's not all about answers. It's about questions. And so the conversation started, and it started in earnest. This magazine was released in July of 2010, last summer. And this is where I came out altogether. This is the magazine that has the article, What Happened to You? You know, I lost my faith. Ojo Uncovered is what it is. And they asked me directly, we've heard on Facebook what you're saying about your beliefs. What are your beliefs? And I laid it all out. And what do you think about the Christian faith? And I laid it all out. So there was my coming out. What have the reactions been? Well, all over the place. I haven't had any death threats yet, fortunately, although some of my friends have warned me that I should get protection sometimes, and that just seems so extreme, but yet I know there are people that do get these kind of threats, and I'm wary about them. But I have heard things like, oh, you're a fraud, you never were a believer, you never were sincere to begin with, you were probably just in Christian music for the money. Ooh. All kinds of stuff. But I should say that there's more interest in what I'm doing now than there was almost when I was a Christian musician, and tons of questions. So the reaction is kind of all over the board. What I hear more than anything is how tragic it is. I see blog posts titled, Ojo Taylor, one of our heroes has fallen. How saddened they are by it. He's lost his faith. No, I didn't lose my faith. My faith died 1,000 deaths. From the minute I walked down the altar, things didn't make sense. And it has died 1,000 deaths over the years. I had no context for what it was like to live outside of that. I do now. What have I learned from this? And this is where I'm going to wrap it up. What have I learned from all this? Well, first of all, the Christians are looking for a fight. Don't give it to them. And by the way, I should preface this by saying this is for me. Not necessarily for you. Many of you maybe are not involved with a lot of... How many of you are involved actively with ultra-religious people, in workplace or family? All right, so some of you, and maybe some of you are not, but I am regularly, every single day, dozens of posts come to my blog, my Facebook page, some very kind and nice asking questions, sincerely, intellectually curious, others not so much. Many of them are looking for a fight. Don't give it to them. I would submit that, you don't have much chance. You have about as much chance of changing someone's religion with debate and confrontation and argument as you do changing their political affiliation. And you know that just, you know, anyone have parents that sit in front of Fox News all day long? You know what I'm talking about. And sorry for the Republicans in here. Are there any Republicans here? I'm sorry. Maybe your parents sit in front of MSNBC and you roll your eyes too. I don't mean that to be a partisan statement. It's just we cannot change people's affiliations just by argument. We've all got our arguments. Second point I've learned from this. They're looking for a fight. Let them have it. And by that, I mean, don't turn down the opportunity to engage. And in fact, I was talking to my partner here, and she said, you know, sometimes the boldest statement you can make is a whisper. And it's absolutely true if that whisper is backed with the facts, with reality, with the way things are, with a certitude that we're plugged into reality and you're speculating. So they're looking for a fight. You can either engage them or not. This idea of context, what have I learned that people need a context for seeing a life without God? I think this is where the arts become critically important. How can I help you see that? And I think the T-shirt that I see, this is what an atheist looks like. The billboards that are going up all over the country, good without God. The billboards that the Freedom From Religion Foundation is doing, that many of you have submitted, that yes, I'm an atheist, here's what I look like. I have a family, I have a job, I'm responsible, tax-paying citizen, you know, all that stuff. I don't eat babies, I don't have satanic sex orgies, and you know, all that other stuff. It's very difficult for anyone to abandon their faith without an idea of life without it. So this is an important thing. We can't just argue, we can't just throw facts around. We need more than that, as critically important as that is. So in this way, the arts can be extremely effective. We appeal to feelings and emotions. That's true. It's not always necessarily bad. In fact, I would argue that's probably what it's for. If I pay $75 to go see someone in a concert and I'm not moved, I'm pissed off. I kind of want my money back. You know, you've bored me. I want to go be transported somehow. I want you to take me on a journey. And so it's not necessarily a bad thing to want to move people emotionally, but it's a responsibility, I believe, on the artist's part. We depend on metaphor, irony, paradox, all these things, asking questions. Stay free. That's my message to myself. Stay free. I'm not interested in replacing one fundamentalism with another. I am not interested in my inquiry is my own. And maybe some of you will disagree with what I have to say, and maybe I'll disagree with you too. But you know what? That's the beauty about this, is we don't have any kind of doctrinal purity to subscribe to. You know, it's like I hear this all the time. Atheism is nothing but a religion. Well, atheism is a religion like the off switch on a television is a channel. You know, it's I don't have a purity doctrine because there isn't one. I don't believe, and neither do you, okay? And some of us are Republicans and some of us are Democrats, and some of us are libertarians and independents and whatever else. Two more points. The Freedom From Religion Foundation and groups like it, advocacy groups like this one, are critically important. When I wrote that article in Downline Magazine, I was inclined just to let religious be, coexist. You know, what a wonderful world that would be. We just all just coexist. You know, you don't put your religion on me, and I won't put my disbelief on you. But it doesn't, just doesn't, rarely works that way, does it? It doesn't work that way. So the other day, I posted about coming here, and the vitriol from the Christians about the Freedom From Religion Foundation. They had gone to the websites, thank God, and one guy had done some Googling and found this article from Dennis Prager. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with this one or not, but there was a Freedom From Religion Foundation lawsuit against the nativity scene in front of some government building. And Prager got his knickers in a twist and all worked up about it. And he said, the people at Freedom From Religion Foundation don't know beauty. They cannot make a beautiful statement. They're atheists, and atheists don't know beauty. This is a friend of mine posting this on my Facebook wall, and I said, what in the world are you talking about? He said, the nativity scene is beautiful. What don't you get? It's beautiful. And I said, look, take away the fuzzy sheep and the donkeys, you ass. And what are you left with? The cute baby Jesus. And what's beautiful about a God who is so offended by us acting the way he made us to act, so offended that he needs human blood sacrifice of his son to mollify him? That's beautiful. Yes, the mythology might be strong, but I'm sorry, it's just not a beautiful statement to me at all. But this is why religion is rarely harmless, and why we need groups like Freedom From Religion Foundation, and why I think it's important for us to support them and advocate on their behalf and to get involved. And I don't think we have to do that in such a way that I'll let you be the judge for how to do that. Love is the umbrella over all of humanity. Love is the big umbrella for your little God, okay? Love is what unites us. To me, that's the pinnacle of the human experience. Everything else is subordinate to that. Religion would have it the other way around. Doctrine is most important, and their version of doctrine is more important than anything. So we must aggressively, this again I'm speaking to myself, aggressively counter any attempt by religion to co-opt or assimilate or own love or any of the other human experiences, the fullness of the human experience. We cannot let them assimilate that because it doesn't belong in the realm of religion. It's the big umbrella, okay, under which religion unfortunately resides. I'll quote the Beatles, you know, in the end, what's it about? It's about the love that we give and the love that we take. My five children, for me, it's about music, free thought, and loveism. That's what it says on my blog. So I've got Edwin Hubble down here in the lower right. We are guided by reason and not with no deference to religious authority whatsoever. Reason or nothing. Love, the highest calling that we have. And for me, that is most deeply expressed in music. This is my daughter up in the lower right, and it's kind of ironic that we're here saving the world in 1994, and she's just waving hello to the camera, you know, looking for the human experience. So thank you very much for listening today, and thank you for your...